This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Clam chowder, baked beans, blueberry pie, New England traditions. But Massachusetts food writer Claire Hopley says there's much more to New England cookery. Listeners, I welcome your telephone calls for Claire Hopley this afternoon. We'll talk about New England cuisine, old and new. Claire Hopley is the author of New England Cooking, Seasons and Celebrations. I encourage your questions and comments, listeners. Join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Claire Hopley writes about food, fiction, and travel for many publications, including the Boston Globe, the Washington Times, and British Heritage. New England Cooking, Seasons and Celebrations is published by Berkshire House Publishers. Again, those telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Claire Hopley, good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for inviting me. It's nice to be here.
Now, I understand you're a native of Old England, merry Old England. When did you come to New England, and how long have you lived there?
I came to America in the late 1960s, and I've lived in New England, in fact, in Massachusetts, since the early 1970s.
Hmm. And did your interest in New England cooking come with you as soon as you arrived? Was it then that you began your interest in the foods of the region?
I think when I arrived, I was, of course, interested in the foods that struck me as different from those of England. And I was also interested, too, in quite often spotting foods that were, or recipes that were clearly similar to recipes in England, but sort of done a different way. But I think when I first came, I had small children, and at that time, I used to be at home taking care of them in the afternoon, and I would start reading cookbooks because I would be looking forward to somebody coming home for dinner, and I would think, well, what shall we have tonight, and so on and so forth, and that's what got me interested in cooking in general, was reading cookbooks. Later on, I began to write a food column for my local paper in Western Massachusetts, which is not an urban area. It's a rural area with a lot of farms producing crops like apples and strawberries, cucumbers. A lot of people produce maple syrup around here, lots of other fruits and vegetables as well. And I think it was that whole combination of things that got me interested in New England cooking was the history, was cooking for a family, and then was writing for a newspaper located in a very rural area with lots of food producers.
Yeah. Growing up in England, were you interested in cooking at all?
I, when I was a child, I was not particularly encouraged to cook, but we lived for quite a long while with my grandmother, who had been a cook. She'd been a servant in people's houses, and when I was a child, a lot of food in England was still rationed. This was after the Second World War. So there was not a great deal of opportunity for experimentation or anything like that. But what my grandmother was always insistent on was that you had to have food that was fresh. We did have a garden where my grandfather and father grew vegetables, so that was relatively easy. And she had a very strong sense of cooking it properly. She didn't particularly like shortcuts, and she certainly didn't like things that came out of cans or packages because she thought they made people sick.
Hmm. That's interesting. I think that I'm not a New Englander, but I would think that sort of sums up my idea of a New England cook would be somebody like your grandmother.
Yes, I think it is. I think there's a lot in the traditions that remains the same, actually. Of course, I think the first Europeans who came to New England were from England, and some of the traditional recipes have survived here. As they did in England, sometimes in different forms, but still, you know, clearly closely related. So I think there are a lot of New England traditions that are very sort of homey and down-to-earth in the same way of my grandmother's traditions in England. At the same time, I think contemporary New England is a very vibrant place for food, with people very eager to experiment with new ingredients, and particularly with cuisines that come from other places. We have a huge range of different ethnic and immigrant groups in New England, and everybody has brought some of their own cooking here, and that's really influenced what everybody eats.
Mm. To what extent do you think has New England influenced cooking in the rest of the U.S.?
I certainly think that there are strong links between New England and the southern states of on the Atlantic seaboard, and I think it's because their histories are quite similar in that they were first settled by English people, and I think you would really need a very well qualified food historian to to sort out what in southern food came directly from England and what from New England, and vice versa. It might require a food historian also to figure out what perhaps New Englanders took from the southern states.
Hmm.
I'm not sure that the influence of New England would be very great in the southwest, but no doubt New Englanders, as they moved westwards into the Midwest, did take some of their foods with them.
Yeah. Well, in the Midwest, I think that we have a strong dairy tradition here, and but not so much, of course, the seafood.
Right.
Not as strong here at all.
That's right. I think the dairy tradition is also historically important in New England, although nowadays New England doesn't really produce quite the same amount of cheese that the Midwestern states do. Still, it's very important. One of the things that I discovered when I was doing research for the book is, for example, how many small cheesemakers there are in the area, as well as some big cheesemakers, typically the big cheesemakers producing cheddar-type cheeses, which is, in fact, a type of cheese that comes from England.
Do regional differences in cooking remain as strong as they once were? I mean, we don't have a tradition of seafood in the Midwest, but because of transportation and whatnot, we certainly eat a lot more seafood today than we did years ago. I wonder if you see regional differences in cuisine weakening.
Yes, I would say that's true. I would definitely say that's true. And I think even in the relatively short time that I've been in New England, for example, I've seen the ability to buy a far bigger range of products here than there were when I first came here. And I go back, I think it's happening in Europe as well, because when I go back to England, which I do every year, I look at the things that you can buy in the supermarkets, and these things were completely unheard of, when I was a child or when I left England as a young woman at the beginning of the 1970s. You just wouldn't have found those things. I think that is happening all over the developed world, and I think consequently people do eat more like each other than they used to in the past.
Mm. When you first arrived in the States, you noticed that there were things in New England that were similar to foods that you enjoyed in England. What were those, and how similar, how different were they?
Well, I think a lot of the desserts, I think, were similar. The sort of apple pie tradition, that kind of pie was very similar. But then you'd have some fruits that are clearly related, but are different. Blueberries are a good example. Blueberries at that time were unknown in England, but we had a wild relative called bilberries, which were a popular berry for pies. Now, just to go back to your previous question, now because of the popularity of blueberries in America, they've started being imported into Britain and being grown there as well. So that's an example of where regional differences are being ironed out. other things that I found similar were some of the meat dishes, the emphasis on beef or on chicken, which was common to both countries. The fish dishes, perhaps surprisingly, were in fact somewhat different, because although many of the same fish live on both sides of the Atlantic, there's a stronger emphasis, say, on lobster and scallops in New England than there is in England. So there, I found quite a lot of differences, and that's perhaps surprising.
I wonder why lobster and scallops wouldn't be as popular in England as they are here.
I think there are not so many of them, and I think in one sense they would be as popular if they were cheaper. They're terribly expensive in England.
Well, they're terribly expensive here, too. And the sad thing is there is a great deal of concern about overfishing. We've seen what happened to cod, and we're looking, I think, at scallops, seeing some difficult times ahead as well. I don't know about lobstering, but...
No, lobstering doesn't seem to be having a problem. In fact, I remember reading in a newspaper a couple of years ago that that there were bumper catches of lobster, and somebody was speculating, I don't know if this is true, but somebody was speculating it might be because the sea temperature is a little warmer.
Interesting. Writing this book, did you learn things about the history of cooking in New England that really took you by surprise, even though you've lived there now for a number of years?
Yes. In fact, there were things that that really were brought into focus, things that, in a way, I sort of knew, but I'd never pulled them all together and said, all right, what does this add up to? One was the large variety of small producers, particularly of things like cheese. Another was the something that I'd always known, of course, that when immigrants came from England to New England, corn was new to them, and they had to adapt many of their recipes to using corn. But I had not really seen how far that went, that there are things like Indian pudding, which is a dessert made of, I'm not sure if you have it in the Midwest, it's a dessert made of cornmeal, molasses, and milk with some eggs and some spices. That seemed to me to be clearly an American recipe. I hadn't realized how much that relates to and comes from, in many ways, 17th century English recipes, where a similar thing would have been made using oats or wheat instead of the corn. And there are many examples of corn recipes of that kind. And I think I'd not really realized either the extent to which in New England, especially coastal New England, the winter diet really was codfish and potatoes and beans, and there was really not much else.
You know, you mentioned Indian pudding, and I think that in Illinois we have kind of an interesting history because the state is large and it runs from north to south, along the Mississippi River, and has a number of other waterways in the state, rivers. And the northern portion of the state was settled by New Englanders, and the southern portion of the state was settled by Southerners. So we have this interesting kind of tradition. At one part of the state, you might have Indian pudding. In another part of the state, you might have spoon bread.
That's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is sort of so similar, and yet, you know, with just that difference in there. I love things like that, where, you know, you can really see a sort of a core history of food, as it were, which in this case I think is the need to make something palatable out of what you've got, which for many people for a lot of the time was some kind of grain and a dairy product. But then, you know, those the little ways, the technical differences in putting it together, or the things that you use to flavor it, making all the difference.
You write about the first American cookbook in New England cooking, Seasons and Celebrations. This was really fascinating. First American cookbook was published in 1796, and the author was a woman, Amelia Simmons. You can't, I know, tell us a lot about her, but the book is really fascinating.
It really is. It's a small book, very tiny. I think in a way, nowadays when we think about cookbooks, we tend to think a little bit of tomes. You know, I mean, even Fanny Farmer is a big chunky book, or The Joy of Cooking is a pretty chunky book, and lots of modern cookbooks are large too. But this really is almost no more than a pamphlet, and the reason I can't tell you much about Amelia Simmons is nothing is known about her background, and she identifies herself as an orphan on the title page. She calls herself Amelia Simmons, an orphan. A lot of cookbooks published in England at this time and in America later, the author would be identified as a lady, but she is very keen on sticking with this orphan thing. And in her introduction, she says that she specifically hopes that the book will be helpful to women who didn't get married, or didn't have fathers or brothers to look after them, and therefore they had to have a skill in which by which they could make a living. So she didn't write exclusively for them, but she particularly had them in mind. So historians take seriously the idea that she herself was an orphan. She published her book in Hartford, Connecticut. And many of the recipes in the book are, it's not just the first American cookbook, but many of the recipes are the first time that we get a recipe for dishes that have become very important to us. And one of them is for pumpkin pie. It's still obviously one of the crucial dishes for Thanksgiving. And another is she has a recipe, one recipe that she calls a cookie, and the next recipe she calls a Christmas cookie. And the Christmas cookie is a very, very much richer version of the cookie recipe. So, you know, clearly we had that tradition way back then of having something extra nice for Christmas.
Yeah, the Christmas cookie, which, by the way is spelled C-O-O-K-E-Y, contains a lot more butter than your everyday cookie.
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
And the unusual thing about it, actually the thing about it that really makes you see sort of history in action in one way, is that basically it is really a butter cookie or a sugar cookie. It's a very, very simple cookie. But the thing that makes it different, and that shows your history in action in another way, is that the spice that flavors it is coriander. And I think now we would be familiar with, say, ginger or cinnamon or nutmeg as flavoring for a cookie, but not coriander. And yet it makes a very delicious flavoring. I've made dozens and dozens of batches of this cookie over the last few weeks, and almost everybody likes it.
I can see where it would be a good addition to a cookie, because it's slightly minty, it's slightly citrusy, and I think it would be wonderful with a pot of tea.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's great.
Yeah. I wonder why coriander fell out of favor as an ingredient in cookies.
I'm not sure about that, because it is so good. A lot of really old recipes will list a whole string of spices for cookies and for other things too. And one speculation is that people did not use all the spices listed, but they used whichever one of this list they happened to have. Coriander is used in pickling spice, and I wonder if that means that people sort of kept it for pickling and didn't think of it for cookies. I'm not sure. Mm.
But once upon a time, it was a common ingredient in baked goods, and then suddenly it, poof.
Just disappeared away, yeah. Sometime in the 19th century, I think.
Yeah, I wonder if there are other things that have disappeared in American... I mean, our history is so... We're so such a young country. I wonder if other things have disappeared from our tables.
Well, I think some of the things that you can even see disappearing, even within our own lifetimes, are, I think people eat less of products such as salt pork, which once would have been really a staple. And now my guess is that relatively few people probably buy salt pork, certainly in New England. And, you know, you could live your whole cooking life and never have a piece of salt pork, even in baked beans. It's a traditional ingredient in baked beans in New England. But you see more and more recipes without salt pork, and I think most people tend to omit it. So that would be one that we can even spot as we go, as it were. And salt cod would be another one. Now in New England, salt cod tends to appear in the shops, in the supermarkets, around February. And then I think it's generally advertised, sometimes with its Portuguese or Italian name, bacalhau. The words are similar in both languages, because it's aimed at ethnic people who keep Lent. Because in Europe, salt cod is one of the big foods of Lent. So I think that we see those things sort of happening now. There are also ingredients that, when you read old cookbooks like Amelia Simmons, sometimes startle you because you wonder what they are. One is pearl ash that was used all over North America, and it was made from wood ashes, and it was a form of leavening. It was a precursor, really, to baking powder, and it died out as baking powder was developed in the 19th century. Pearl ash became less common, but it was a kind of baking powder that most people could make at home because most people had wood ashes to make it from.
A recipe that you've included in your book is for mincemeat. This, too, seems to be slowly disappearing. I've had mincemeat pie. I've seen it, you know, made, prepared in the store where you can buy it, you can purchase it, but I have never made it. And it was very interesting to see what all is in it and to think that, well, there's other uses for mincemeat besides putting it in a pastry shell.
Yes, that's true. Mincemeat is a recipe with a really long history. It goes back to medieval England and probably was made in other parts of Europe too. And in those days, late fall was a time not only for hunting wild animals, but farmers really didn't have the kind of fodder so that they could feed many animals over the winter, so they always killed off many of them in late fall. And so, of course, they would have more meat than they could immediately eat, and they had to try to find ways of preserving it. And one common way was salting it, of course, but mincemeat was another way. And what they did was chop up the meat and mix it with dried fruits like raisins and currants, and with apples, or something else like apples, but most commonly apples, and with spices. And it was a sort of a luxury way of preserving the meat, because salt meat was typically not very tasty, but this was a luxury, and because it was made near Christmas time, it became associated as with Christmas and as a festive food. Now, what's happened over the years, it was mincemeat came to America with those first English immigrants, but what happened over the years is in both Britain and America, the meat started getting left out of it. And although you do find some recipes that still include meat, particularly in New England, you'll find those recipes often in community cookbooks, and they will be geared towards hunters who have venison. And they have the old problem of all of a sudden they have a lot of venison and what to do with it, and mincemeat is one thing. But mostly nowadays, mincemeat doesn't contain meat, and it's just a mixture of apples, or it could be made with green tomatoes as well, and dried fruits and spices with alcohol to preserve it and some fat to enrich it. A lot of recipes will specify suet, and a lot specify butter. I think it's a great pie filling, and as you just mentioned, you can make other things with it. You can use it in pound cake. You can use it in cookies. You can use it in ice cream.
And this is an idea that I really liked: baking apples with it packed in the center.
Yeah, that's great. That's terrific. It's a very easy filling. You know, it's already sweetened, so you just core your apples and fill them with mincemeat, and that's it. You're in business.
Claire Hopley is our guest this afternoon. We're talking with her about New England cooking. She is the author of a cookbook by that very name, New England Cooking Seasons and Celebrations. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, I welcome your telephone calls in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our first caller this afternoon is waiting for us on line one on a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My grandmother used to bake cookies, and she used an ingredient that I remember as hartshorn. Can you identify it for me?
Yes. Hartshorn is almost exactly as it sounds. It was an early thickening agent. It was often used in things that people wanted to gel, and it was initially made by grating horn, particularly deer antlers. It was used in England as well as in New England and other parts of the United States. So it could be used as I'm not sure that it would have been a raising agent, but it certainly was used a lot in things for in desserts, usually to thicken or gel them. And it had to be cooked for a long time once you'd grated it.
What I remembered is having a very strong ammonia smell.
That would explain its use as probably a raising agent, because early raising agents, now baking soda is bicarbonate of soda or sodium bicarbonate. All early raising agents like hartshorn or pearlash were also some other sort of chemical, such as potassium carbonate, and you know, ammonia is a likely one because it would rise. So that's why you've probably got the memory of the ammonia smell. Actually, although I know a little of the history of hartshorn, I've never actually seen it, I must admit. So again, it's an example of a once common ingredient that has almost entirely disappeared.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Next, we go to a listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. I think this product is off the planet. I remember my mother getting dried or salted codfish in wooden boxes. I grew up in Lansing, Michigan, and, you know, it wasn't very near the East Coast, but she'd cream codfish. Well, she'd soak the codfish, because I remember our cat one time put its paw in the dish and pulled out a piece of the soaking codfish, pulled out a piece of codfish, and which made my mother a little disturbed. But anyway, and she would cream it, and we'd have it on baked potatoes.
Is there any such thing? Yes, those wooden boxes of codfish, you can still get them in New England. They're not produced here. They're imported from Canada, from Nova Scotia usually.
Well, that'd be fine. How in the world would I get a box of dried salted codfish in a wooden box in Urbana, Illinois?
Well, I think that you might call. There's a fishmonger in Champaign.
Oh.
Out there at the old farm shops.
Yes, I know.
And you might give them a call because I've seen it there.
Oh, well, that's good to know. I'll just get right out there then. And that was a wonderful winter dish.
And I think during Lent you might find it at a larger grocery store.
In the little wooden boxes.
Yeah.
Reminds me of the song Clementine. Use those wooden boxes for shoes.
I don't know.
You're not familiar with that.
No.
Old song. Well, thank you for the great suggestions.
Well,
I'll probably have some for in a couple of weeks.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Are you familiar with the song about the Clementines?
No, I'm not. Although I remember my father used to have a saying that somebody could have feet as big as kipper boxes, which might be the same thing.
I think that's the same idea exactly. Let's talk with another listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi, I think I'm line one.
That's you.
Yes, I'm calling in reference to the hartshorn. That is also known as ammonium carbonate, and I remember buying the last that the druggist had at a pharmacy when the pharmacy went out, and I still have some that I use for Christmas cookies, particularly Norwegian cookies, often use the hartshorn or ammonia.
Oh, that you see, I suppose that would be because in Norway, too, they would have a lot of access to that. That's really interesting.
It makes a very... It's a very short, light cookie, and the ammonia in the smell of the cooking of it or the mixing is all gone when the cookie comes out, and it's just a lovely, lovely ingredient. And it is difficult to get. I don't know. I haven't tried to get it for some time because I did get the last of the pharmacist's supply. The other thing I wanted to ask about was you mentioned coriander. This is another spice that's used quite a lot mm-hmm. in the Scandinavian things. The coriander seed I have always is in the husk.
Mm-hmm.
Is the husk supposed to be separated, or is it just ground up with the rest?
Well, when I buy it, I usually buy it already ground, but I do have it in the berry form, like you have. And when I've used the berry form, I've ground it simply with a pestle and mortar, and then sieved it, and sieving it will leave the husk behind and just get you the powder through the sieve. I think the husk is quite, obviously wouldn't hurt you to eat it, but it's you know, it's quite brittle and it wouldn't be a pleasant texture. Certainly I don't think you'd want it in cookies.
No, I've used it in cooking. All Mexican or Indian foods use mm-hmm. coriander, and I've just used the whole berry. But in cookies, I hadn't thought about sifting it, so that would be a very good suggestion.
That's right. And I think, in fact, I mentioned before that coriander is one of the seeds that is in the mixture for pickling spices. For those not familiar with it, it's a little bit smaller, perhaps, than a peppercorn, and it's a sort of beigey color rather than dark brown. But the other place where people might have tasted coriander without quite knowing that that's what they were tasting, is it is one of the constituents of curry powder.
Yes.
It's not hot. It doesn't. It's not mm-hmm. a hot taste like chili or ginger, but it's in there in the mixture of spices that is typical of curry powders.
It's a very good flavor.
It is. It's a nice flavor.
And one thing more about the mincemeat.
Mm-hmm.
I regret that mincemeat has become so difficult and expensive when you do find it,
mm-hmm.
because one of my favorite cookies was always mincemeat cookies, and people don't even recognize that you can do that with mincemeat.
That's right, that's right. It's good in cookies, and it's good anywhere, I think, where you might think of putting raisins plus spices.
Yes.
So in cookies, in a pound cake type cake, or even in like a quick bread, a plain quick bread, or you could make mincemeat muffins. It's really a convenient thing to have on hand. I make it every year, and it goes.
I made it once with green tomatoes, and it mm-hmm. was not my favorite.
Uh-huh. But I usually make it with apples.
Ah, okay. I very often have a little extra apple or raisin that I put in with it. And I thank you for mentioning Indian pudding, because I haven't made it for some time, and I think I will have to get my recipe out and have some.
It's very good, isn't it? Especially
it's a lovely, lovely dessert.
Cream.
Yes. So we thank you very much for all your comments.
Well, thank you for calling in.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. No one's waiting at the moment. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And I am told that a caller called in just to let us know that the Kipper box line is the same as the Clementine box line in the song. Same idea exactly. And I wanted to ask you some, you know, we've been talking about coriander, and it's interesting that this is a spice that seems to be used in cooking around the world. And having said that, I'll just put that out there as a comment. And then I want to go on to the shakers.
Mm-hmm.
You include some very interesting information in the book about the Shakers and their influence on cooking in New England and indeed in the rest of the nation, because they are the ones that really led the way in introducing herbs to the kitchen. And coriander comes from a plant that is also used as an herb, cilantro.
Yes.
So there you have that. So anyway, the Shakers... What led them to such an interest in herbs?
The Shakers, they were a religious group who lived together in communal villages. They shared their property, and they formed large villages that where they tried to be self-sufficient. And, of course, that they arrived actually from England, but their history is almost entirely in America because it was a very small group when they came from England. And here they blossomed. They arrived at the end of the 19th century, the end of the 18th century, and by the middle of the 19th century they had got villages all over New England and in parts of the Midwest and even a few in the South as well. Because they were trying to be self-sufficient, they grew all their own food, and they grew a lot of food for sale, or they would also make food for sale, and they also grew plants and seeds for sale, because by selling products that they could grow or make, they got the money to buy the things they couldn't produce for themselves. And their early herbal catalogs contain... in most cases, well over 100 different herbs, including many things that we wouldn't be using for cooking or for any purpose nowadays. And so originally, they were interested in many of these for medicinal purposes, because in the 19th century, there were not that many doctors, and medical knowledge such as we have today was not well developed. And people, particularly rural people, and the Shakers were rural people, really had to know of a lot of ways of curing themselves. And herbs was one of their main ways of doing that. There's a Shaker village in Sabbath Day Lake in Maine where there are still about half a dozen Shakers living. And they have reprinted one of the catalogs from the middle of the 19th century in which they had only four herbs, and it specified for kitchen herbs. So they did use herbs in the kitchen, but they used most of them for medicine, at least at that time. And then gradually they began to use more and more of them in their cooking, and they had very stringent, I suppose what we would now call quality control, in everything they did. So they developed a reputation wherever they were for being excellent in all their products. And so I suspect that a lot of the herbs that we now use came from them, partly because they were producing them and partly because they used them in the foods that they made for sale to the people who lived around them.
Hmm. Thinking of the Shakers and preserving foods, one can begin to think about smoking as a way of preserving things. Is this a long New England tradition, let's say, smoked fish, for example?
I think smoking is a long tradition, but in its early days, it was a somewhat hit-and-miss kind of process. There is an early cookbook written in New England called The American Frugal Housewife that was first published in 1832 by Lydia Maria Child. And in it, she speaks of using smoked fish. And it's almost, if you know, that this is the worst kind of fish you can probably have. And the reason for that was that the way of smoking it would be that people would just simply hang it up in their fireplaces. They really didn't have smokers that like we have now. And salting fish was very, very much the standard way of preserving fish, so probably people smoked it only to give it a slightly different flavor or only when they had huge amounts. It certainly was not a delicacy. But then, later in the 19th century, New England began to get a lot of immigrants either directly from Ireland or Scotland, or indirectly from Scotland via Canada. And both Scotland and Ireland and the Scots in Canada did have a long tradition of smoking fish. The reason why the Scots and Irish smoked fish rather than salted fish is that the climate there is much wetter than it is in New England in the winter, and they couldn't smoke fish by letting it dry in the open air because it rained too often, basically. So they had to develop better smoking methods. And for them, smoked fish was their tradition. And when they started coming to live in New England, they wanted their smoked fish. And some of them started smoking businesses. And smoked fish did become quite popular, at least in coastal areas of New England, in the late 19th century. And then it seemed to have disappeared for a little bit and to have come back more recently as salmon farming developed off the coast of Maine. And, of course, salmon farming produces a regular supply of salmon throughout the year. Without salmon farmers, we would only get salmon in summer when the fish come back from the sea to swim up the rivers. But with that regular supply of salmon throughout the year, the salmon farmers had to start looking at ways of doing something to it to make it, to use it, so they had a market for it throughout the year. And so smoked fish has once again become very popular in this area.
Now, that's interesting, because in Canada, in northeastern Canada, a place that I've visited, the smoking sheds have all but disappeared. However, they're farming salmon, but what they had been smoking in those sheds, which are mostly now torn down, herring.
Yes.
So making
kippers.
I wonder if those sheds will make a reappearance given that the salmon industry is so strong there now.
Yes, I wonder. It would be nice to think that it would, but I know in Maine, people who began smoking salmon have really branched out, and now they smoke mackerel and trout and scallops and shrimp, bluefish in the summer. They have a whole array of it. So this is an excellent example of a kind of food that's becoming more and more popular, I think. You know, where a few years ago it would be virtually impossible to buy smoked salmon, but now there's lots of businesses do it.
Mm. I want to thank you very much for the recipe in the book for Anadama bread. Because this is something I don't think most Midwesterners are familiar with, and if you've been out in New England and have been treated to this, it's wonderful. Whether it's for just with butter or toast or French toast, is there in New England a taste for sweetness for flavored breads?
Well, among traditional New England breads, I can't. Think of another one. Anadama is certainly sweet because it has molasses in it.
Mm-hmm.
New England cornbread is generally quite sweet as well. It's got a sort of slightly cakey taste. But other New England breads, I think, probably are not. Portuguese bread is a popular bread in New England, and that comes in two forms. One is very much a sweet breakfast bread, but the other is not. It's a particularly nice plain white bread. So perhaps Anadama and sweet Portuguese bread, but not typically otherwise, I don't think.
Oh, well, I would encourage folks to look that up and make that, because
yeah.
It's delightful. The other thing I wanted to ask you about before we go that comes to mind when I think of New England cooking, fiddlehead ferns, and this is a very seasonal thing, although you can also get them frozen in New England. But what type of fern is used for that?
These are ferns that grow on riverbanks. It's not, although they don't look different than the kind of ferns that grow in forests, they are different, and they're called oyster ferns, generally, and in the book I do give the Latin name for these ferns because you need to know the right ones. But the fiddleheads are the part of the fern that first comes through the ground. They're really the fern shoots, and when the fern first comes through the ground, it curls, so it looks a little bit like the end of a violin, and that's when they're picked. And anybody who's seen ferns at that stage of growth will know that there's like a little brownish husky stuff sometimes around it, which as the fern grows, it casts that off and it becomes a fern. But since you're picking them just at the shoot stage, when they're just about probably no more than 3 or 4 inches tall, you rub that off, and then you just drop the fiddleheads into boiling water for a few minutes and cook them and eat them, quite like the way in which you might eat asparagus, which is another shoot, actually.
Are they cultivated in New England?
No, I don't know that they are cultivated. They're certainly not cultivated in Massachusetts. If you want them here, you pretty much have to go out and pick them yourself, or just occasionally in spring you will find somebody in a farmer's market or perhaps even a supermarket has some. They're there very briefly. I know in Maine there are people who can fiddlehead as well as freeze them, as you said. I don't believe they're cultivated, but it could. They might be. I don't know of anybody who cultivates them.
That's a wonderful treat too, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And the traditional thing to eat it with in Connecticut and Massachusetts is shad, which is a fish that swims up the river in May. It's a fish like salmon. It lives out in the ocean, but it comes back in the rivers to spawn in May, and it comes back very conveniently just as the fiddleheads are ready to pick. So if you really want to live from the wild, as it were, you can go out and catch a shad and pick some fiddleheads on the riverbank, and you've got a wonderful meal just right there.
Yeah, and that would be high on the hog in my book. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Claire Hopley has been our guest this afternoon. She is the author of New England Cooking, Seasons and Celebrations. The book is published by Berkshire House Publishers.